Italian parents and brought up in England, I suppose some practical experience of the national question, not to talk of the recent football disasters that we've had. I'm talking about last night, not when England lost, by the way. It's when Italy lost. But it's an important theoretical question, but not just from a point of view of theory. Theory for Marxists is not an abstract question, it's applied to reality. And without a clear understanding of the national question, we can make some very big mistakes. And actually, Lenin understood that without a correct position on the national question, the success of the revolution itself would have been at risk. In What Is to Be Done, he actually says in the first few pages that without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. Now, we often find in the labour movement and on the left a kind of poo-pooing of theoretical questions, as if they're not that important, because what's important is the practical struggle of the day. And Lenin was very hard on that kind of question. He says later on, he said, talking about what might be unimportant errors, he said, "What at first sight appears to be an unimportant," and he puts "unimportant" in inverted commas, "error may lead to most deplorable consequences, and only short-sighted people can consider factional disputes and a strict differentiation between shades of opinion inopportune or superfluous." And he goes on to say, "The fate of Russian social democracy for many years to come may depend on the strengthening of one or the other shade." And he puts "shade" in inverted commas. Now, that's how important he considered theoretical questions. And he highlights, he even quotes Marx on when Marx said, "The important thing is to differentiate and clarify where you stand. Then you can also collaborate with other political forces, but not by confusing your ideas or watering them down, but by being crystal clear on where you stand." Now, the question of the national question, where does it come from? You see, the national question, historically, was a problem that should have been solved by the bourgeoisie in the formation of the nation states. It's actually, you know, things like the right of self-determination, the right to set up your own national state, is actually a democratic demand. It's not a socialist demand. But it's not being solved by capitalism. And why is that? Because if we look at the history of capitalism, capitalism created nation states. Some countries, like Britain, because of its borders and its history, and a few others, have had a distinct identity for a long time. But if you look, I would argue that peasants a few centuries ago were not particularly aware, conscious of the nation they belonged to. And if you look across Europe, the creation of nation states, say the crystallization of Spain into a state, Italy, Germany, and others, came about on the basis of the development of capitalism. Now, why, comrades, as you come in, can you be? I lost my track, you see, that's what happens when you're old and you upset somebody as you're walking in. I'm not trying to embarrass you. I'm trying to remember what I was saying.
Why?
Huh?
Why?
Why what? This is terrible. The brain cells of a 60-year-old. Let's start again. No, the development of capitalism required a bigger market. That's the essence of the creation of nation states. If you look at Germany in the 1800s, the early 1800s, or Italy in the same period, there is no Germany. There is no Italy. Somebody, you know, I think it was Metternich who said Italy is just a geographic expression. Italy has the advantage of being a peninsula that you can still identify on a map. But it wasn't called Italy. It was called the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. It was called the Papal State. It was called Tuscany. It was called Lombardy. Part of it was occupied by the Austrians, etc., etc. Germany, you look at the map of Germany, and it was just lots of little statelets. And the problem with that is that these small statelets are an impediment to the development of capitalism. Now, there's an Italian comedy film where they actually go back into the past. Francesco is what I'm talking about. Two guys go into the past. I want the aim of going into the past is to stop Christopher Columbus discovering America. And the reason for it is that this guy's sister was engaged to an American, and this guy detested Americans, so he tried to stop America being discovered. But in their journeys across across Europe at the time, they cross borders constantly. And there's one scene where they go across with the cart, and there's a guy sitting there with a desk that says, one florin, because they cross the border, they've got to pay. As they're going over, something falls off the cart at the back and falls back across the border. So he gets off the cart and walks across the border, and the guy sitting at the desk goes, one florin, and he has to pay the florin. He picks up the sack, puts it on there, walks back across, and he says, one florin. And it's a very funny sketch in Italian, but it shows you what it was like to move goods across that kind of situation. You're paying taxes and tariffs constantly, and it's an impediment to the development of basically what is a much bigger market. Capitalism required bigger markets, and capitalism therefore created the modern nation state. It's an expression of the needs of capitalism, because the productive forces under capitalism begin to develop way beyond the dimensions of these small little states. And therefore, capitalism pushed for the creation of bigger entities. Germany was an expression of that. Italy was also an expression of that. And many others. And eventually, we end up with the creation of the nation states that we all recognize today. But the question is this. What kind of nation states did they create? Does the bourgeoisie limit itself purely to uniting people who speak the same language, or have the same religion, or have the same cultural identity? The problem with capitalism, it's not a system which is based on respecting national minorities or cultural differences. How can a system which is based on the exploitation of the working class behave in such a way? It has no respect for the identity of peoples. And it's a rapacious system which tries to expand its market constantly, and therefore tries to expand the borders of its states. And that means not simply, I don't know, unite all the French-speaking people, or unite all the German-speaking people, or unite all the Italian-speaking people. There's a tendency of the bourgeois in the creation of nation-states to incorporate and to take over peoples that are not the same, let's say, as the majority, like the Bretons in France, or the Corsicans. The Corsicans actually speak a language which, I've read Corsican, I can understand it perfectly. It's much more Italian than most of the dialects of Italy in the way they speak. But the Genoese had a bit of a problem, and I thought, well, what can we do to get a bit of money? I know, well, we'll sell Corsica to the French, which is what they did. And that was the source of a problem in Corsica, because the Corsicans historically did not consider themselves to be French. Probably, if history had evolved without it being sold, it would be part of Italy like Sardinia is now. But even in Sardinia, you have a national question, because the people feel distinct from the rest of Italy. And there is a nationalist party there, which gets significant votes. In Corsica, even more so, because the centralized French state is very, very oppressive when it comes to the way it's dealt with its minorities, like the Bretons, the Corsicans, the Basques, etc. So the tendency for bourgeois states is to centralize and incorporate peoples which are not in identity with the rest of the population. Now, that means that what we have, if you look around the world, and you look around Europe, is nation states, or let's say borders of capitalist countries, which have within them peoples that are very different. Spain is a clear example. In Spain, you have the Catalans, the Basques, the Galicians, and others. Catalan was oppressed under the Franco regime. There was an attempt to integrate them to the degree of cancelling out their language. Now, if you think about it, from a long historical point of view, the integration and centralization is a progressive step. Otherwise, if we went right back in the history of Britain, for instance, we'd have to go back to a period when people were speaking different forms of English in different parts of England. And what's progressive about that? The progressive nature is a common language which allows for a bigger state, which allows for bigger development of productive forces and a movement forward of humanity. But the problem with capitalism is it doesn't provide development at the same level for all peoples. There's the uneven and combined development nature of capitalism. So some areas are more developed than others. Some of them remain behind. Some of them have greater degrees of poverty, greater levels of unemployment. And when you have this kind of inequality, which is inevitable under capitalism, then what happens is, where there is some kind of identity, which can either be a linguistic identity, i.e., like the Catalans, who speak, you know, like Catalan is different from Spanish, very similar but different, distinct language, or a geographic expression, such as Corsica, which is a combination of geography and language and history. Historical, like the Bretons, go back centuries, people which have spoken a different language from the French for centuries, or the Basques, which go back, well, thousands of years, actually, as a distinct people with a distinct language. Where there is this, you can have a separate identity, and it can be a religious identity. You can have peoples who are basically the same people, who speak the same language, but adhere to different religions. And one of them could be, say, a minority religion within the country. Different characteristics, but which gives you a separate identity within what is a centralized bourgeois state. You end up with people identifying with that, and they express their need for a better life. That's what it's about, i.e. jobs, housing, etc. Through their own national identity, i.e. the idea develops that we're oppressed, we're oppressed by Madrid. If we separate from Madrid, there'll be more resources for us. We'll have more control over Harrow. It's an undeveloped expression of a revolutionary aspiration of the peoples, i.e., we want greater control over our affairs, but the thinking is we want more jobs. Now, of course, because they don't understand the nature of capitalism, they don't understand the source of the problem, which is the capitalist system which creates these injustices. It's very easy for nationalists, bourgeois nationalists, petty bourgeois nationalists, to push the idea that the problem is the English, or the problem is the Madrid government, or or it's Paris, or whatever. And if only we were to separate dominating central power, we could solve our problems. Now, if we look at how the national question, it comes up and it recedes according to the situation that capitalism itself is in. And I'll give you an you can look at Europe as a whole. In the period of rising capitalism, and especially if you look at the post-war boom, where in a lot of countries there was full employment, the welfare state was being built, pensions were being granted, the jobs, decent wages, the national question tended to recede, not in all cases, but mostly it tended to recede into the background. And the different identities tended to become more blurred in the sense that it wasn't an issue because everybody had jobs, life was getting better, nobody felt particularly oppressed. But the identity remains. And what happens is when the crisis of the system begins, and you have growing unemployment, you have life starts to get more difficult, wages are not going up as much, all the problems that come with capitalism. Now, either there is a revolutionary party of the working class, which can offer a clear answer to the problems of working people. You know, unemployment exists not because, the Galicians or the Catalans or whoever, or in Italy, it's the North-South question. You know, you blame some other people within the nation state. The problem is the system. It's the capitalist system and it's the capitalist class that owns the means of production. Now, a revolutionary party sufficiently strong with roots in the working class and in all of the peoples could explain that the problem is the system. Now, Lenin dealt with this question and he took it up because you could have a very abstract, simplistic outlook, which would be, well, if there's a revolutionary party that explains the need for socialist transformation of society, then the national question is solved. And there was actually a debate, there was a difference of opinion, let's say, between Lenin and Rosa Luxemburg on this question, because Lenin emphasized the need for the Bolshevik party, it's the famous Article 9 of the statutes of the party, to have within the party program the question of self-determination. And Lenin explained, in a country like, the Tsarist Empire, where the majority of the people that lived within its borders were not Russian, more than 50% of the peoples were, of the various different republics and nationalities that exist within what became the Soviet Union. Lenin understood it's not enough simply to say to the Ukrainians, to the Belarusians, to all the various peoples, look, support us, we're the revolutionary party, we will change society. Once society's changed, then all these problems will go, there'll be jobs for everybody, and just forget the national question, and we centralize. Now, Lenin explained that the ideal, all conditions being equal, the ideal is for greater centralization and integration. And mixing and coming together of peoples. But having said that, he understood that you can't just simply pose that bluntly to peoples who feel oppressed and feel there's a historical oppression there that's gone on for centuries. And this becomes part of the psyche of each national grouping. Lenin actually developed the idea that the Revolutionary Party must explain to the people who belong, the minorities, the oppressed minorities, that the Revolutionary Party of the working class is prepared to grant you full separation and the creation of your own state, if you so wish. Now, formalists would say, that means Lenin was for the disintegration of the centralized state. Lenin explained that it was actually the opposite. You see, the bourgeois, in crisis, create a situation where breakup and separation becomes practically inevitable. Look at the situation today in Iraq. The situation in Iraq, where we have the de facto breakup of the country taking place before our very eyes. You have the Kurds in the north have their own regional government. They have a prime minister. They even have diplomatic representatives, although it's not classed as an independent country. According to the constitution, the Kurdish area of Iraq is part of the Iraqi state, but it had its own armed forces. We have the conflict between Sunnis and Shiites that has erupted. Now, what is the base cause of this situation? Well, first of all, the way these countries were created, let's not forget how they were created. They were not created by the imperialists saying, well, here, 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 and here are Kurds. We'll draw a border which more or less gives the Kurds their own country and call it Kurdistan. Here, here, and here we have Turkmen, and we'll give them an autonomous region or state or whatever. None of that. The bourgeois consciously created states with a built-in division whereby you apply the method of divide and rule. The British are experts at this. They've done it everywhere. Ireland, the situation in Ireland, is a product of this policy. In Ireland, the people who live in the island, in this island, all speak, well, most of them speak the same language now. It's English. Gaelic is spoken by a small minority. But fundamentally, they all speak mostly the same language. The conflict in Ireland is between Protestants and Catholics. How was that created? Well, the British actually they brought in Protestants as labour into Ireland, and built up a minority, which they could make them feel that they could only be safe if they're part of the union with England and the rest of the United Kingdom. And it's based on religious difference. You can't tell a Catholic from a Protestant by walking down the streets of Belfast. They speak the same language with the same accent and they look the same. But there's a difference. And that difference has led to the building of walls, which are still there, separating communities. And this is a creation of capitalism. And the same was they did in Cyprus, where they put Turks against Greek Cypriots. They did the same in India. And when they left these countries, and if you look at the Middle East, the map of the Middle East, you see these straight lines that go on for hundreds of miles. That nobody can say that's a natural development of history, that there's a line there where Arabs and Persians are separated naturally by that line. No, they draw a line according to their own interests, and they make up states like Iraq, which has within it different minorities, which means that the imperialists could continue to dominate these countries from outside once they've been forced to leave. And you see the situation that we have now. In the past, the Sunnis dominated through the Saddam Hussein regime, although they're a minority. With the collapse of the regime and the invasion of the country, we have a Maliki government which is based on the Shiites, which is oppressing now the Sunnis, and also in the past the Kurds. But the Kurds have established certain, in reality, basic independence. So we have a conflict within peoples. The Shiites and the Sunnis are actually both Arabs, but they belong historically to different different forms of Islam in this case. In the case of the Kurds, they have the same religion as the Sunnis because they're all Sunnis, but they speak a different language. They're historically a different people. These different identities are at the basis of the conflict. But what's at the root of the conflict? It's the immense poverty, the unemployment in the country, and the conditions created by the invasion of the country by the imperialists. And you see how complicated also the national question becomes today, even compared to 100 years ago. There's a minority in Kirkuk, in a region that's called the Turkmen. Historically, they looked to Turkey for protection. They're a small minority. The Kurds, the oppressed Kurds, now have established de facto independence. With the collapse of the army in the Sunni areas, the Iraqi army is in a mess. What do the Kurds do? And here you see how an oppressed nation can transform itself, or has the potential to transform itself into an oppressor nation. They grab Kirkuk. Now, Kirkuk is not completely Kurdish. It's a mix, actually. There are Arabs, Sunni Arabs. There are Shiites. There are Turkmen, who are a different people. And what's happened now is the Turkmen have started arming themselves. And at the moment, they're leaning on the Kurds for protection against the Sunni insurgents. But they don't trust the Kurds. They don't look to the future. They're not too happy about the future of being a minority within an independent Kurdistan. So you see, in many cases, the actual breakup of countries and the formation of new states doesn't automatically solve the national question, because there are minorities within minorities. And to try and apply rigidly the position on self-determination can actually lend... You can end up in a big mess. Take Nigeria, for example. Nigeria was created as an entity by the British. There were two provinces. There was the northern province and the southern, which were parts of the British Empire. The British, what do? Before leaving, they fused the two areas together, which basically means fusing the predominantly Muslim north with the predominantly Christian south. In Nigeria, there is not one ethnic group which has a majority. There are big groups like the Yorubas, the Igbos, the Hausas. But there are 120 languages spoken in Nigeria, and roughly 120 tribes. And there are groups and subgroups of these national groups. And with the development of capitalism, even more so than in the past, with the movement of peoples, you have these people not living in separate regions. This is a Hausa region, so this separates, you solve the Hausa question. No, there are Christians living there too. And then there are all the other tribal groups. In the south, in Lagos, you have Hausas, you have Yorubas, you have Igbos, and then, of course, you have Yorubas who are Muslims and Yorubas who are Christians. So even purely on the question of what language do you speak or what tribe do you belong to doesn't end the story. And if there was ever an ethnic conflict which led to the peoples looking for separation in Nigeria, it would be an enormous bloodbath. It would not solve any of the questions. And actually the smaller nations are terrified of the breakup of the country. Because it's one thing to be a small nation within a federal republic where there's lots of small nations. It's another thing to become a small minority within, let's say, a Yoruba-dominated southwest. So on a capitalist basis, in a lot of countries, there isn't actually an immediate solution. You cannot actually pose the question of self-determination in Nigeria without posing the question of, this is going to actually lead to civil war and ethnic cleansing, with people being attacked on all sides and people being pushed out of one area and rushing to another for safety, which is actually what's beginning to happen in Iraq. We applied this idea also to the north of Ireland. Now, when Ireland was basically a colony of Britain, we defended the right of Ireland to be an independent state and separate from colonial oppression. But Marxists understood that solution really lay in the socialist revolution in Ireland, not just a solution to the national question. Because on a capitalist basis, what happened was, and the British successfully maneuvered on this, they had to concede independence to the majority of Ireland, but they kept the six counties in the north. And they kept them in such a way that there was a rough balance of 60% to 40%. 60% Protestant, 40% Catholic. Very little difference between the living conditions of the Catholics and the Protestants in Northern Ireland. But you make the Protestants feel as if somehow they're privileged. You go and get a job, the Protestant will get the job, and the Catholic won't get it. The Catholic maybe has to emigrate. Create an idea that somehow the Protestants are privileged because they're protected by Britain, i.e. you're creating a base for the support of British imperialism inside Ireland. And that was the source of conflict for decades. Now, how do you solve the national question in Ireland? Now, we are for one united Ireland. The question is, how do you achieve that? Can you achieve it on a capitalist basis? We would say no, you cannot achieve it on a capitalist basis. Because on a capitalist basis, think about it. The Protestants, majority in the north, would be transformed into a minority in the whole of Ireland. And because Ireland is a capitalist country, and it's a Catholic-dominated country, for example, little detail, you know, can't have an abortion in the south, you can in the north. So a Catholic in the north actually has certain advantages to belonging to the north in questions of social welfare, etc. But the Protestants feel, and they know, they would become the oppressed minority in a united Ireland. So they're not going to willingly accept that kind of united Ireland. They would fight. And you'd end up not with a solution to the national question in Northern Ireland, but to a civil war, a bloody civil war, and at best a redrawing of the borders with a smaller statelet and, you know, pure Catholic, pure Protestant. But to achieve that, if anybody's been to the north of Ireland, you know that there are Protestants and Catholics all over the north, in Belfast, in Derry, etc. And in order to have a pure Protestant state, you'd have to shift people. And the same the other way around. And that wouldn't happen on the basis of, gently, kindly, leave your house, please. We're going to give this to a Protestant. Leave your house. They're fight. And it would lead to a reactionary development on both sides. Both sides are in a conflict, moved to the right on a base of nationalism and national hatred towards other peoples. And who benefits are the most reactionary elements. And in Iraq, you see that. Amongst the Sunnis, although initially there were the social conditions for a people's uprising, The shift is towards Sunni nationalism, and the people who've come in, these insurgents, they've reduced the price of a lot of basic goods. They're providing a better supply of electricity, by the way, but it's mainly for the Sunnis. The Shiites and the others don't feel safe. They're not returning to where they've been kicked out of. They're fleeing to areas where they feel safer. That's the result. They will end up backing a reactionary Shiite movement in the other parts. They're volunteering en masse. What do you think they're volunteering for? They're volunteering to go and fight the Sunnis. It's going to be Iraqi against Iraqi. That is the result of the invasion. This is the solution to that problem that Blair and Bush came up with. We've had the situation of Yugoslavia. Now, that's another example where an historical national question. Now, what is the national question based on in Yugoslavia, fundamentally? Croats and Serbs speak the same language. It was called Serbo-Croat. Now, in Croatia and in Serbia, the nationalists on both sides, no, we speak Serbian, they speak Croat. And they're consciously introducing differences, words, spellings, etc. They're trying to separate the two peoples, which are basically the same people. But what the history of the country means that one part was dominated by powers which were the Christian Orthodox religion, and the other's Catholic. So the Croats are Catholics, the Serbs are mainly Orthodox. And then you have the complicating element that when the Ottoman Empire came in, if you converted to Islam, you got a discount. You didn't pay your taxes. And so it shows you how religion really grips the minds of people. People in the cities thought, well, become a Muslim and don't pay taxes. That's the origins of the Muslims, the Bosnian Muslims. But they speak the same language. They are the same people, divided into three. And on this basis, you have this terrible killing in the breakup of Yugoslavia. But if we go back in history, after the Second World War, the Yugoslav peoples were united in the struggle against the Nazis, the partisan movement. Subsequently, on the basis of a federal republic, where each peoples had its own autonomous, let's say, republic within the federation, and on the basis of a very important element, economic growth of something like 10-11% per year for a long period, the national question in Yugoslavia receded to the point where Sarajevo was a cosmopolitan town. Intermixing of peoples. After all, you speak the same language. So you're a Christian Orthodox, and you're a Catholic. Not a huge difference anyway. They lived peacefully together for decades. When did the national question reemerge in Yugoslavia? On the basis of the crisis of the economic system, which was Stalinism. It was a planned economy, but it was a version of Stalinism, where the bureaucrats of each region, of each republic that made up the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, I remember, they started blaming other people. It's the fault of the Croats, it's the fault of the Serbs, it's the fault of the Macedonians or whatever. And they turned the people against each other for what reason? To stay in power at the top. But once you unleash that process, and remember, you had inflation at one point in Yugoslavia of something like 2,000%. That means people were being completely ruined. The middle classes were in a terrible state, and the workers were suffering. There was something like 1 million unemployed, and there were a further 1 million had emigrated out of Yugoslavia. There you have a people who had lived peacefully together and were actually integrating more and more. And think about it, within the federal structure, you have a Croatian republic which is part of the federation. Within Croatia, you have a Serbian minority, which so long as you had a federal republic which respected all the different minorities, they lived peacefully together. When the conflict erupts, the Serbs living in Croatia become victims of a movement to the right in Croatia, and a shifting of peoples across borders. Why did this happen? The root of it was the economic decline of Yugoslavia, but behind it were the imperialists, German imperialism in particular. They saw in the potential for the breakup of Yugoslavia to get back into what was formerly a sphere of influence, their sphere of influence, particularly the Croatian part. But they saw that by breaking up Yugoslavia, the imperialists could get in and start to exploit, basically, the country, expand their markets for their own goods, and expand their influence in the region. And the Vatican played a role. The Vatican immediately recognized Croatia's right to self-determination. Isn't that nice of the Vatican to do that? They obviously had at heart the interests of the Croats. The reality was, first of all, they wanted the breakup of the old planned economy. There was still state-owned industry and a planned economy, although deformed. That had to be eliminated, and it had to be privatized and taken back by the capitalists, mainly West European capitalists. That was what was behind the breakup of Yugoslavia. However, on the basis of a formalistic application of the question of the right to self-determination, there were groups who call themselves Marxists who called for self-determination in Yugoslavia. And for all the peoples. But the point is that in Yugoslavia, supporting one or other of the nation meant supporting civil war. I remember being on a demonstration in Rome, and there were different sects there. One of them was calling for the self-determination of the Serbs. Another one was calling for the self-determination of the Croats. And I thought, it's lucky you don't have a section in Yugoslavia. Because if you did, your members would be fighting each other. That's what it would mean. If you support, even if critically, the Croats, you support the Croats against the Serbs, it was a crime against the Yugoslav peoples. We opposed the breakup of Yugoslavia. We didn't oppose the right of self-determination in a mechanical way when it came to Yugoslavia, because as Lenin pointed out, and Marx also pointed out, and if you look at Marx, there are moments in which he supports the Poles' right to separate, moments in which he changes his mind. What determined it? Well, it was the overall interests of the revolution, not just in one country, but on an international scale. When Russia was a bulwark of reaction, Marx saw in the separation of Poland a weakening of Tsarism, and therefore a weakening of a bulwark of reaction in Europe, which was moving towards revolution. Later on, when the movement in Lenin points this out, when the perspective in Russia was one of moving towards revolution, Lenin opposed independence of Poland. He said because they should be part of this revolutionary movement. It depended on the moment, and they changed their position according to the conditions. It's not a fixed category, the question of the self-determination. It depends on the interests of the working class and revolution. Some situations, to push for separation, is reactionary and plays into the hands of the imperialists, particularly on the Balkans. This is a historical thing. Trotsky referred to this in his writings on the Balkans. Especially if you look at the makeup of the Balkans, there's such a mixing of peoples that it's not a clear-cut question of, I don't know, Sardinia separates. Well, they're all Sardinians. It's not so complicated. On the Balkans, there's a mixing of peoples, different enclaves, different people live in different parts. And therefore, to call simply an abstract for self-determination, how do you apply it? Now, does that mean that we're against self-determination even in these cases? What we say is, on the basis of capitalism, self-determination in those particular conditions are reactionary and pushes the struggle of the working class back. Now, the solution to the national question, in the end, is a class solution. It can only be solved on the basis of a socialist transformation of society. Now, going back to Lenin pointed out that in order to win the peoples of the various minorities, it was necessary for the working class of the dominant nation, which was the Russians in this case, i.e. this Russian working class had to make it crystal clear that we, in coming to power as a class in Russia, will end the discrimination of the Tsarist Empire in relation to you, the minorities, and we are prepared to go as far as to allow you, if you so wish, to separate and form your own state. Why that? That was a necessary message in order to cut across the influence of bourgeois and petty bourgeois nationalism and point to the workers of the Ukraine and other republics We, the Russian workers, have no interest in oppressing you. We have an interest in uniting with you against the common enemy. And you see what the Russian Revolution actually solved the national question in the old Tsarist Empire, precisely by applying this method. And what you had was the Socialist Revolution spreading to all of the republics, and the working class of all of these republics voluntarily joining a union. And think of it, they didn't even call the union, they didn't call it Russia. They consciously avoided that. They called it the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, a union. And the idea was that it could spread, this union. You could join it. Other peoples could join it. The Poles could have joined it. The Finns could have joined it if the revolution had been successful in these countries. And through the revolution, that question was solved. The republics existed with the rights of different nations, the right to use your own language, your own culture, your own religion, etc., but within a centralized federal structure on the basis of a socialist revolution and the working class coming to power. But what happens next? Stalinism. This is not a discussion on Stalinism and why it emerged. It's the isolation of the Soviet Union, and we've discussed that elsewhere. Once the Stalinist bureaucracy comes to power, with its inability to develop the productive forces beyond a certain level, i.e. to the level necessary to create material conditions for the gradual elimination of the national question in the Soviet Union, you have the Stalinist regime actually turning back to an oppression of the minorities. In the Ukraine, the purges that took place, and the collectivization particularly hit the Ukrainian peasants. But Stalin went to the degree where he moved whole peoples, the Tatars and others, to other parts of the Soviet Union, uprooted them completely. Even to this day now, the Tatars in Crimea have a little problem with being part of Russia, because that is still in their memory, that how they were treated by the great Russian Stalin, who wasn't a Russian, but a Georgian. With the oppression of Stalinism, the national question re-emerged into the Soviet Union, to the degree that Trotsky posed the question of the independence of the Ukraine. Imagine this, that this is the flexibility of Marxism. After having basically solved it through the revolution, because of the degeneration of the revolution and the coming to power of a bureaucratic caste, a privileged layer at the top of society, oppressing the national minorities, Trotsky saw the danger of bourgeois nationalism getting a grip within the Ukraine. Today, even today, you can see it's there with this historical division within the Ukraine, a harking back of one section to basically what were Nazi collaborators and others who remember the anti-fascist struggle. But Trotsky saw that in those conditions, the Bolshevik Leninists had to pose the question even of independence of the Ukraine, but a socialist Ukraine, i.e., you present it as a way of breaking away from the grip of Stalinism in order to establish in the Ukraine, not just an independent Ukraine, but regenerate the workers' democracy and the genuine workers' state which had been thrown up by the revolution. And he did that in order to cut across the bourgeois and petty bourgeois nationalism which was developing. Of course, it was a small force and had very little influence, but Trotsky's position was correct. Subsequently, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union and the breakup of the Soviet Union into its component parts. Why? Because the collapse of the economy in the Soviet Union towards the end, the impasse that society was facing, all the central feudal forces came out and it splintered. All the different republics broke away from the Union on a bourgeois basis, and now we see the consequences. The Ukraine being separate from the Soviet Union has not solved any of its problems. In fact, they've exacerbated them. But even within this, you have the problems, such as in Russia. You had the Chechens and Dagestan. These are other areas. Within Russia, still you have minorities that feel oppressed to the degree that they felt they had to send the tanks in to crush them. What was it based on? On the collapse of the economy. Now, we have to explain that the solution to this question everywhere is an economic, fundamentally it's economic. You provide jobs for everybody, and people will live peacefully next to each other. And if you can do it for long enough, a long historical period, people will actually mix together, blend together, cultures will be influencing each other, languages will influence each other, and there'll be a harmonious development of society towards basically a world integration of peoples on a peaceful basis. Nobody will feel oppressed by anybody, and everybody will feel that the system provides the basic needs. But having said that, that doesn't mean that the day after a revolution, everybody says, well, that's it. We're no longer concerned about the Russian oppression, or the Corsicans will forget all their past and what's happened at the hands of the French central government. It will take time. Therefore, that's why the question has to be posed in such a way as to say, self, you have the right, if you so wish, to separate. And the capitalism, at its height, tended to integrate, to centralize and to enlarge states. Even the creation of the European Union itself, at the peak of the boom, was a movement towards a greater economic integration of states with very different histories and different languages. It was an economic necessity of capitalism to create a bigger and bigger market. Even the market of the European Union is not big enough. And yet, you see this contradictory process. All over Europe, the national question is re-emerging. It's emerged in a big way in Spain. In Italy, the Northern League, this is one of the incredible developments of the national question. There was never an identity of the Northern Italians as a nation. Turinese are not that, you know, the Venetians, miles away over there, they're different. But how did it emerge? On the basis of the crisis of Italian capitalism, and also the corruption and the collapse of the authority of the political system, you have an idea, which is a reactionary idea, by the way, and it's an expression of the crisis of capitalism. In the North, which is historically better often than the South, you have the tendency towards separation. On what basis? Well, if we separated from Rome, we wouldn't have to pay the taxes, and we could keep all the resources for ourselves and lower taxes and be better off. A reactionary development, but it's a consequence of the crisis of the system. And Italy only came into existence, really, in the 1860s through the struggle for a national unification. Even then, the question of the bourgeois, when we say the nature of the bourgeois and its limitations, even when it was uniting countries like Germany and Italy, the bourgeois expressed its reactionary nature. And it sometimes took elements which went beyond the bourgeois at the time, just like in the French Revolution. In order to successfully carry out this French Revolution, the most revolutionary wing of the bourgeois had to take the lead. And then obviously they were crushed by the bulk of the bourgeois who were trying to reestablish their control. In Italy, it required a Garibaldi who gets on a couple of ships and sails to Sicily with 1,000 men, and then lands in Sicily, and you think, well, this is it's not quite the same. It's a bit like the people in the sunny areas now, a small group, successful. Why? Because the mass of the people, the sunnies at least, are supporting them. What happened in Sicily is the peasants rose up because they thought this was a revolution taking place, and the army expanded into tens of thousands and marched up, and he overthrew all these despotic regimes, and the king of Italy moved to try and stop him because he was going too far. He wanted to take Rome as well. Want to take the papal state. But there are moments in which you see you need more decisive figures and more, in a sense, revolutionary figures to push for this. And then, of course, the bourgeoisie accept the end result, a national unification and a national state with a bigger market, and they use it and they exploit it and all the rest of it. But they don't solve all the underlying problems. So long as capitalism is moving forward and the productive forces are being developed, the national question tends to recede. Once the productive forces cease to be developed, slow down, and actually can go into reverse, which creates terrible social conditions, growing poverty and differentiation, the national question comes back, and can even come back where you wouldn't expect it. Who would have guessed 20, 30 years ago that you'd have the question in Milan, of all places? You'd have thought in the past that it would have been Sardinia. We have a document here. It's called Nationalism and Separatism of the Italian Section, and it refers to the Val d'Aosta, where they speak French, the northeast, where there's some Slovenes and Croats, all that, and the South Tyrol, where they speak German. No reference to Milan, and yet that's where the problem has actually emerged on a much bigger scale. And there's an economic base to it, of course. Now, in Britain, we have the phenomenon of Scotland and Wales and Ireland, but the union between Scotland and England goes back 400 years, and it was considered by many, well, you know, unthinkable that the national question could even reemerge in a place like Scotland. Lenin pointed out, however, that even in Britain, he pointed this over 100 years ago, even in Britain, where it seemed that the Union was now, you know, consolidated, the question could re-emerge. And in here, it's not a language question, although sometimes it can be, some comrades, but they're still speaking English, basically, with a different accent. It's not a religious thing. It's not a language thing. But there's a border there, and there's an identity. And a lot of people in Europe don't understand this. You know, the number of times I've spoken to Italians and said, oh, I was in the north of England. And they say, oh, you mean Scotland? And I says, don't you go to Scotland and say that. It's not the north of England. They don't even understand that, what is this Scottish thing? Why do they have their own football team? They can't, because they think, well, you know, we have regions too. He said, no, it's not that. It's deeper than that. It goes back centuries. The identity has been maintained historically. In the long historical perspective, if you have a big development of the economy, then you could see a coming together and a mixing and inter. And this would be a long historical, a bit like Wessex and Mercia. Who today says, "Well, I'm a Mercian. I'm from Wessex." It disappeared years ago. But the Scottish identity is a clear. It's a separate one, just like the Welsh. And because that identity is there, and because of the crisis of capitalism, it's re-emerged, and in a very big way, to the degree that Scotland could actually separate from England. We will see what happens there. And what is our position? We defend the right of the Scottish people to separate. We defend their right. Just as we defend the right of people to have a divorce. We've written this and spoken about it. But to defend the right to divorce doesn't mean that we knock on everybody's door and say, are you married? Yeah. Best thing is get a divorce. And go to the next house. Are you married? Yeah. Divorce. No good. Being married is a bad thing. I mean, everybody has their opinions on that. But we say you have the right to. If the situation is so bad, we defend your right to do that. Just like abortion. We don't go and knock on everybody's door, pregnant woman, and say you should have an abortion. It's a good thing. But if you have a problem, if you need to, we defend your right to do so. That's the kind of negative position. We defend the right to do so, but we don't say it's a good thing. So we don't say, oh, we defend the right of Scots to separate. If they vote to separate, we will defend their right to do that. But we don't say, yes, it's a good thing to do so. Economically speaking, it's not. And it won't solve any of the problems on a capitalist basis. And we must stand out on this and warn the Scottish people and the Scottish workers that a separate Scotland is not going to give you power over oil. It's not going to give you better health care. It's not going to solve any of the fundamental problems. And if we present our position in a skilled way, which means also we have to be very sensitive on this question. Because there's a problem sometimes with these discussions that you can say, well, it's reactionary because it's a step backwards. It's a breakup of the economy. And therefore, we go out there and just campaign, no, 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 because it's bad. We have to show sympathy and sensitivity towards the very people who think there's a solution in this and explain to them, we defend your right to separate if you wish. But remember this, the SNP are tartan Tories, the SNP are bourgeois, they defend a bourgeois policy. Scotland will remain under the control of British capitalism. We can quote James Connolly said to the Irish that if you raise the green flag over Ireland, if you don't remove the landlords and the capitalists, England will still continue to dominate. Well, in this case, it's the Germans, the Americans, and maybe even the Chinese now are coming in. Basically, you won't achieve what you want from that. And we say the same to the Scottish people. In the long run, the solution will be socialist revolution. But the way we apply it and the way we raise the question of self-determination, it's not a fixed, rigid thing that you apply always in exactly the same way. You consider the concrete circumstances, the history, and you consider that the most important thing is the effect it would have on the question of class struggle and the struggle for socialism. In Yugoslavia, it was a completely reactionary step backwards. and we gave no support whatsoever. And yet there are groups who claim to be Marxists, even Trotskyists. And I have here, for instance, internal bulletins from 1984, when it was the militant, on the national question, which puts a correct position. It puts exactly the position we put. It explains just what I've been saying. And yet, a part of that tendency, the majority, went off and ended up posing the question of self-determination in Yugoslavia as a necessary demand, forgetting completely everything they'd been educated on. And you see what a mess. Now, you see, having a correct position on the national question can, in certain moments and circumstances, create temporary problems of reaching certain layers. I'll give you an example. 1969, the British troops were sent into Northern Ireland. One tendency opposed that in Britain. That was us. We were opposed to the sending of the troops. Why were they sent in? With what excuse were they sent in? To save the poor Catholics who were being attacked by the Protestants. We warned and we said what the British troops would be there for, and we opposed it. SWP, Mandelites, they all supported the sending, supporting British, you know, imperialist troops being sent in to Ireland. Subsequently, when it became clear what they were there for, they turned into their opposites. Troops out, and that was it. And no consideration for the actual way that was going to be achieved, i.e. through class struggle and the struggle for socialism, not just in Ireland, but across the whole of the British Isles and across Europe. But decades later, there are people in the Republican movement that we've met who remember articles that Ted wrote on this question in 1966. And they remember the position that we took. And we're able to discuss with them because of the principal position we took. And I guarantee you that in the ex-Yugoslav republics, there are going to be a lot of people who will see us as a serious tendency because we opposed what happened at the time. Because they can see what a mess it is. You know, it's not by chance. Our comrades in Serbia told me, Fred, you know, we've got contacts in Bosnia that have joined the organization, and we're thinking of setting up a Yugoslav section. And I said, well, I have great sympathy for you, Philip, on this, because that's how I would think. But let's discuss concretely how that would be perceived on the ground by Croats or Serbs. But the idea is correct, because the most advanced layers amongst the youth and the workers in Croatia, Serbia, etc., will look back to what happened as a huge disaster and a step backwards. And any tendency that supported that breakup will have no authority with them. That's why, when I go back to the beginning, what I quoted from Lenin, what is to be done, why we pay such attention to what can seem to be a detail. But you make a mistake over a detail like that. What seems to be a detail in one moment can be a huge problem in another. And that's why discussions like this for us are not academic. They have practical consequences in the way you apply this question, the way you deal with it when it erupts. And I'll tell you something. Even in the building of the organization, it has an impact. In Canada, we are the only group on the left, that claims to be Marxist or Trotskyist, that has both Francophone and Anglophone comrades. We have a branch in Montreal of must be close to 20 comrades. Most of them are French-speaking. And think about how strong the question is in Quebec. There is a strong desire amongst the Francophones to break from the Canadian state, because they see that as the oppressor of the Francophones. Historically, they were. And yet, we've won. We've won. And we're building. In Nigeria, we won a group of comrades up in the north that come from extremely underdeveloped areas. You can't imagine how backward it is. You know, women cannot be in the same room as men. Even within the organization, it's impossible. They just, the pressure of society. And we've won. We've won comrades. On what basis? And the comrades told me, on our position on the national question. We don't have a simplistic separation of all the rest of it. We raise it in a much more complex way. So even it has, this discussion has practical consequences for the building of the organization today, and in the long term, it has consequences for the way we would apply and the demands we would raise, the aim of which is not to separate, actually, but it's to unite. But Lenin understood, in order to unite, You must make it absolutely crystal clear that what you're fighting for is a system where there would be no oppression of the minorities. And it's to remove an obstacle. And on that basis, the workers of the minority nation will unite with the majority nation in the class struggle against capitalism. That's the final objective, is unite the working class, not separate it. And one last point, Lenin insisted on this, one party for the working class, one organization, and not Ukrainian, Belarusian, Georgian, or whatever. The party that fights for socialism does not have to break up along national lines. In fact, it's an obstacle to the building of the organization. We maintain a united organization in the struggle, even though that united organization in the different parts of a state can pose the question in a different way. You know, Lenin explained the duty of the working class that belongs to the oppressor nation is to fight its own ruling class and defend the rights of the minority. But the duty of the Marxists that belong to the minority nation is not to cozy up to the petty bourgeois and bourgeois nationalists, but to fight them and explain to the Scottish workers, that the nationalists have not got the interests of the Scottish workers at heart. They will defend the interests of the British bourgeois. Once they're in power, they will apply bourgeois policies. And you fight them, so that there's different nuances also on the way you present this question, depending on the where you are, because it's who you're talking to also that determines how you pose the question. But one central aspect of it, obviously, is that the solution to the problem is class struggle, united class struggle, and the struggle for socialism, taking over the resources and using them to the benefit of all the peoples. That's, in the long run, the solution. The way you get there is not a straight line where you reject the question, the national question, and you regard it as unimportant. It's an extremely important question, which can determine either the victory or the defeat of a revolution in certain circumstances. And I've gone over my time, so I'll leave it there.